Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the weather now with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at the UW-Madison, also a professor there of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin, professor and past chair.
That's correct.
You sound a little happy about that.
I just like the accuracy.
So it's great to have both of them along. You may have a question about the weather. Have you seen a water spout ever? Have you witnessed an interesting weather phenomenon lately? We already have a couple of cool photos up that we're going to be talking about from my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. So I hope you might just go ahead and go to that while you're listening and take a look at the cloud photos that are up there right now. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. Well, guys, a few weeks ago, there was an amazing sighting of water spouts on Lake Michigan just off the coast from Kenosha. And we had some great ones, great photos posted on my Facebook page. And somebody said, what the heck is a water spout? John, what's a water spout?
It's just a kind of a weaker tornado, a vortex that gets itself oriented vertically, and it's easy to condense, you know, the air around the vortex because you're over a marine environment. And the big one in Kenosha, though, the last couple of weeks ago, was probably an F0 tornado. That was a really substantial vortex, very wide. Usually you don't have to worry too much about danger in the vicinity of these water spouts. But I doubt that that was the case near that big one off Kenosha. That one you didn't want to be anywhere near. That was a pretty substantial storm. So, yeah, that's as far as I understand, that's pretty much what they are.
Yeah, it's funny because we often say that, you know, that they're not that dangerous, you know, particularly in comparison to tornadoes. But I know I saw even a weak one in Florida in the Keys, and there's Gary looking.
Oh.
And there's pictures of the people who were passing around. Yeah, were just phenomenal.
I'm going the other direction.
Yeah, it's not something you're just going to say, I wonder what that's about. And, you know, go there and stick your nosy power your boat in.
I don't think it's good to advocate curiosity to that level. Yeah, you're right. They're really impressive to look at.
Well, what are the conditions that cause them?
Well, this one with Kenosha was an isolated, really intense thunderstorm. There were several that went through the Chicagoland area. That one was the most northern of that whole bunch, and it really looked impressive on the radar. So that's why I suspect it may have been a tornado if it had stayed over land. But it was very easy to spin up the waterspout over the lake, and it was impressive. So it's really the same kind of, you know, thunderstorm convective environment that generates regular thunderstorms that have a threat of tornadoes that does it with waterspouts, too.
And do they last about the same as, I mean, how long would they typically last?
I think that's true, isn't it, Steve? They have about the same lifetime.
Yeah, I think the weak ones, they don't, there's not that big vertical forcing that you get in a thunderstorm that's generating a tornado. So I don't think they last quite as long.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we have some photos, and I want to see if you guys can lean over here. And there's one from Barb. Barbara took this last Friday in the Avoca area. The clouds aren't easy to see, but I was wondering if the weather guys could tell me what's going on to make the clouds look like this. And you've kind of got a wispy.
It's kind of a very wispy. It looks to me what would be an old contrail coming
old
out of a jet aircraft. And so it spreads out, and usually there's turbulence associated with it. And so that gives you that rib structure that you can see in the photograph. But it's a very thin cloud. It's part of the ice cloud classification, Cirrus.
Okay, and then here, Denise sent us something, and of course now I put it up and the picture went away, so let me go back here because, all right, so she is wondering about these clouds that look like fat and thin yarn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, these clouds and the fast-moving clouds above them appear in Badoga Bay, California, a few times a year. And so, oh, crumb. So
I'm guessing that's a what's known as a roll circulation.
That's what it looks like to me, too. It looks like it's going to be in place if you were to run the video.
Yeah, probably right. Or maybe very, very slowly moving. But in the movie, you'd probably be able to see the circulation around the cylinder or the cloud.
Yeah.
Okay, so I can't do it because I need an upgrade in my flash player. But because there was a movie set. But kind of a cool...
Yeah, it looks like what we call it's like a roll cloud tier series, which have different names, but they're clouds that are arranged in rows. And then if the video it probably is showing, as John was saying, it's probably just rotating because it's associated with upward and downward motions in the atmosphere. And so you get these nice little rolls of clouds.
Yeah, quite interesting. There's some famous ones in the north coast of Australia, the morning glories. They're called come rolling in off the Bay of Carpathia, is it, or something like that?
Yeah,
I forget what it's called.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're really people. It's a tourist attraction. They come with such a regularity at certain times.
Oh, you're kidding?
Yeah. No. Yeah, really amazing.
Steve Eckerman and John Martin, our weather guys, with us today from the UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Give us a call with your weather question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. At the Larry Mueller Show, you can post a question or a photo, weather photo, or both, of course. You know, there's been some really horrible flooding out west, especially in Colorado. What kind of precipitation did they get to cause all that?
Well,
it must have been a lot.
It was tons. It was a tremendous amount of precipitation. I think Boulder got more rain, almost as much rain as they usually get in a year.
In 24 hours or so.
Yeah, or four or five days. With a big punctuated amount a couple of times. It was astounding. And there were some towns to their north and east, maybe north and west, that were even worse off than them in terms of people getting stranded and so on. So, large-scale setup was such that the air was coming off of the longest fetch across the Gulf of Mexico and then right up the gut of the Central Plains and hammering the Southern Rockies. And it was forced to go up because of the slope of the topography, and there was also some other weather factors involved besides just the geography of the region. That's an unprecedented sort of event.
Is there always flooding when you hit a certain level of precipitation, or does it obviously, it depends on other things, too.
Yeah. It depends on what the, where that water is going to go. And in the case of the Front Range, it's all going to go downhill. And Boulder sits in essentially a floodplain from the Big Thompson that comes out of there. And so, all that water that's raining in the mountains is going to find its way down there. And then it also depends on the condition of the soil. So if it's too dry, you've probably seen, the ground gets really hard. And so it won't absorb that rain when it comes down, or if the ground is frozen. So anything or if the ground's too wet, then it can't get absorbed
that's
either.
Right. Yeah. And the point about runoff's a really good one in this event. I guess it stopped raining in northeast Colorado for a couple of days, and they were still experiencing massive flooding well to the south because the water was finally catching up in the streams and rivers.
Yeah.
So, there's no way to get out of the way of that rolling water. It might fall in the Boulder area, but it's going to hit you if you're down there in far southern Colorado.
And if you looked at river stream gauges, you could actually watch it come.
Yeah, that's right.
And even in satellite images, you could watch the areas get flooded as the bulk of the water kind of hit that region.
Unreal.
Yeah.
And you guys, speaking of falling, you guys recently wrote an article for the State Journal, Wisconsin State Journal, about how fast rain falls.
How fast rain falls? Yeah.
That was a good question.
Yeah. We get some good questions every now and then.
That's right.
And it was faster than I thought. I think it was like 10 to 20 miles per hour or something like that.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was more like in around 10.
Yeah.
But it was 20.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
It so how do they figure that out? I mean.
So it's physics. The falling terminal velocity of anything depends on, what its shape is, how heavy it is, and we know how big raindrops are. And so anything that's fallen is going to reach this constant velocity, what we call the terminal velocity. And if we can make an assumption about the size of the drop, we can determine what that is.
Yeah, and the shape of the drop. You see an artist will always...
Do it as a teardrop.
Teardrop, yeah. Yeah. But that's not the...
No, they're like a... gets flattened out. It's like a pancake with fat edges, right?
Yeah, like half of a hamburger bun. Yeah. Yeah. So the artist does it to make it look like it's falling, right? Because that's what they want to make us see. If you did a bunch of hamburger buns drawn in a drawing, you would wonder, what's that water doing there?
What the heck is that all about?
I want some of what he's drinking.
Right,
Well, here, you know, all that rain out there, and here we are. And we had some rain over the, you know, at least southern Wisconsin got some rain. I'm not sure how much across the state, but we're sort of in a drought, aren't we?
Yeah. It's almost like the western half is.
Yeah.
It seems like now the northern part of Wisconsin is doing pretty good, and the western part's in pretty drought conditions.
Yeah, and we were in a sort of a minor drought here in the southern part of the state after our dry end of July and August, but it's not extreme like it was last year.
Right.
But it's there nonetheless, and we're way ahead of the average for the total precipitation of the year. So it proves that it's how it's distributed that matters, not how much you get.
Oh, okay. What are the figures?
I wish I knew off the top of my head. There was a time not long ago we were about 10 or 12 inches above normal. I don't think it's drastically different now. Okay. It's probably down to about 8 inches above normal for the year, but that's a lot. That's a lot of it.
But that all fell.
Yeah, from March to late June. Yeah. You know, we had that miserable wet.
Oh, spring. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It was really wet. And incessantly.
Yeah, kind of.
I've forgotten about, you know, you almost forget about that.
Yeah.
Well, what about coming up? What are the we have a reliable forecast coming up here?
They're looking at temperatures-wise for the next month and even the next 3 months as being a high probability of being above normal. And precipitation, again, they just don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to. Yeah. There's no real driving global circulation anomaly that can, you know, switch us into some sort of pattern like an El Nino or La Nina. So
right now, I'll say this: we're way above normal in the Western Hemisphere at about a mile above the ground, as far north as almost well north of the Arctic Circle, which to me means there's no chance of getting early snowfall in Western Canada, far northwestern Canada.
Oh,
and if that's true, that might mean it isn't going to be sharply cold in the beginning of the winter.
But yeah. You won't have the cold pool of air to come down and get
cold.
Yeah,
that only covers November and maybe the beginning of December. But still, that's not far out.
Yeah.
Or not too far away. But right now, we're not putting snow down on the ground in the high latitudes of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
Not
okay, so it's going to be warmer for sure then.
If I had Larry's money to put on it, that's what I'd say.
You're not putting a lot down then, are you?
No, I'm not putting very much down. This is a penny ante game.
Right.
We're talking weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You can join in too. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. And please, if you got a weather picture, post it on that Facebook page. Back after the news. There is never a shortage of things to talk about when we get into the weather, especially with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They'll talk about what we're experiencing, what's on the weather horizon, and they can make us a whole lot smarter in general. If you want to join in, I hope you will. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Martin, professor and past chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
And Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, also a professor in the department. Steve, always a pleasure.
It's great to be here on this wonderful day.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful weather day.
Yeah. We talked about earlier, we talked about water spouts and just got into tornadoes a little bit. We didn't get into hurricanes.
Oh, yeah. It's because we're not having any,
yeah.
At least in the Atlantic.
Why the heck? I mean, we're right in the middle of the hurricane season, aren't we?
We're actually past the peak. I mean, it's usually middle of September where the peak frequency is, and we've had almost nothing happen in the tropical Atlantic. It's not been zero in the Pacific, but even the Pacific has been less than normal, the far western Pacific. But it's a pretty amazing year of little or no tropical cyclone activity, and that is bound to have consequences for the hemispheric weather patterns the rest of the fall and winter. How exactly those consequences are manifest is a very good question, because it's kind of an unusual event. Yeah. We don't have a lot of historical guidance on such a thing.
And so the hurricanes transport energy, so now somebody else is going to have to do it.
That's right. Something else is going to have to do it. The tropical oceans won't be ventilated. That might mean next year is doubly impactful. Who knows?
Yeah. And they were predicting a above normal year with hurricanes, too.
Right.
So why didn't? So they were predicting above normal? Was there some temperature or something that was?
No, it's just that the prediction is such a joke. And I'll say that on the air. I'm glad I just did. It's a joke. Yeah. There's no reason to believe any of those seasonal forecasts of tropical cyclones, and yet they get incredible amounts of press. Every year it comes out, May 15th. But it's a joke.
It's seasonal forecasts are really, really hard.
Right.
Whether you're doing hurricanes or tornadoes or winter storms, it's just... That's what the challenge is.
It is definitely the challenge. And I think when you're dealing with a season that has a limited number of events that are going to occur, even an active one, somehow it just captures people's imagination because of the severity of the storms. And the people who make these seasonal forecasts get away with it when it comes to hurricanes. No one makes seasonal forecasts of winter storms.
We should. You and I should start.
Yeah,
I'm going to forecast 26 winter storms. I'm not going to define what that is, but I will define it in March.
Exactly.
So you're predicting 26.
Yes, I'm going to now soon work for the Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah.
I'm
going to do it. Right. You just have to plaster
I just need a good cover.
Oh, man. You can join in, too. Maybe you want to have a prediction for us. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or maybe you just have a weather-related or climate-related question. Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page, at The Larry Mehler Show. We'd love to hear from you. Well, you guys are always looking involved in research of one sort or another. Let's take a minute or two to talk about some of the things that you're up. John, start with you.
Yeah, okay. We were just in Montreal last week, my research group and I, at a really great small conference of people who work on weather systems and how weather systems interact with the climate system. So it's kind of getting bigger and bigger. And these are weather systems both in the mid-latitudes and in the tropics. So we went there and we talked about how the Pacific jet varies intra-seasonally and also between years. We're interested in that, and that has a huge impact on weather in North America and weather downstream, even all the way to Europe. We're trying to understand that problem better. We're also looking at how really high-impact weather events can sometimes result from the unusual vertical superposition of the polar and subtropical jet streams. There's really two jet streams in both hemispheres. It's particularly obvious in the northern hemisphere. They occur at different latitudes and different elevations. But occasionally, circumstances that we're still trying to figure out draw them together and end up being right on top of each other in the vertical. Circulations associated with them are much stronger, and they tend to be associated with very heavy weather events. The Nashville flood in May of 2010 was a clear example of such an interaction, and my student Andrew Winters talked about that. And then finally, we're looking at whether or not the cold air that's produced during the wintertime in the northern hemisphere is getting smaller area-wise as time goes on, and it appears that it is. And that's a really important tropospheric climate signal that has, as it turns out, lots of ramifications for sensible weather around the hemisphere in the wintertime. So we're learning more and more about what does the shrinking cold pool mean for sensible weather during the wintertime.
There are fewer cold days, or the cold days aren't as cold, or
well, it's a little different than that so far in what we're saying. We're saying that the area of the hemisphere that is occupied by air of a certain threshold coldness is smaller now than it was in 1948, and it's systematically smaller, I should say. And despite that, there's a lot of variability from one year to the next, and that variability is connected to the weather. So that's what we're trying to understand.
Yeah. Is it smaller but colder?
No.
Well, you can't know.
No, there's less voluminous air of a certain threshold temperature. In fact, less massive. And so you can convert it directly to a certain amount of energy that's being retained somehow by the atmosphere to make less cold air. And I haven't done that calculation yet because I've got a little bug in my program. But once I figure it out, I think I've got a very simple number to throw at people who study this from other perspectives. And I'll bet you our numbers match up.
So that's going to mean that, or is that more, data toward the fact that we have climate change?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's a very novel way of looking at whether or not the planet's warming. over the last, in this case, 65 years, and it's undeniably true that it is. And these are data that no one ever refutes their accuracy. They're not contaminated by being near cities or being, you know, not near cities and so on. It's middle tropospheric temperature data that we have great confidence in, and it tells the story. And the story is pretty much hard to argue with. So it's very,
very interesting. Steve, what are you doing?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a meeting, too, with a combined meeting of U.S. Satellite meteorologists and the European satellite meteorologists at a combined conference. And looking at a couple of things. One is getting ready for the next generation weather satellites that NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, will be launching, scheduled now at the end of 2015. And so we'll get some new advanced satellites, finally. The ones we have up there now do great stuff, but they were built in the 1980s. It's time to get some new technologies up there.
Wow.
And then the other thing is, you know, the satellite data record is now over 30 years old. And so we can really get now the resources, the computers to actually access that data and analyze that data and start looking at how things are changing global-wise over the last 30 years. We like to call it satellite climatology, but it's not really a climate because one climate point is often an average of 30 years. But we're able to look at what the changes are. And so I'm particularly interested in looking at, you know, changes in cloudiness over the Great Lakes and how that's related to what's going on with the lakes. So that was... that's been kind of fun. We got a paper submitting today.
Oh, is that right?
Sending it out. Yeah, it's been sitting in my desk all weekend. Now I didn't do anything but look at the fog.
You know, it's amazing to me. I mean, when we think of how frequently we replace our computers and our smartphones and everything, that our satellites have been up there since the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, it's built on that 80 technologies.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's
And you guys are always building new instruments to probe in more sophisticated and refined ways into the atmosphere and the ocean system. And it takes how many, was it the average 15 years from the time the thing is actually a prototype instrument in the lab?
Yeah, it takes a long time to build them. That's the issue. Yeah. And they have to be space qualified. And, and there are some new satellites. I mean, NASA's, along with NOAA, are... launching new satellites, but so I'm talking about the geostationary, the ones that really monitor the weather.
And they've made a revolution in the way we can forecast the weather too. It's just, you know, you'd like to be able to go on the road and say this, you know, when people are saying the government can't do anything right. It's absolutely wrong. Okay. There's no other way to do weather forecasting than to make it a big government enterprise, not only in our own country but around the globe. And we take for granted the advances that have occurred in the last 30 years or so, and a large fraction of that advance is a result of satellite involvement in the process.
So now, are these new sophisticated? Are they going to, is that going to improve our ability to?
That's what we're hoping, particularly on the smaller scale. So the, you know, giving more advanced lead time for severe thunderstorm outbreaks, being better instead of, you know, marking out a whole bunch of counties, you know, trying to get that down to a portion of a county of where the thunderstorm might be breaking out.
Oh, well, that's a huge difference.
Yeah, it's a big difference. We're getting more what we call wavelengths to measure, but also the spatial resolution. It's like cameras. They're getting better. The temporal resolution, like videos, we'll be able to capture more imagery and really watch these storms develop. And if you see these, if you go online and search for, we do use the current satellites to kind of get ready for the future ones and some of the capabilities that we can reproduce. And one of those is to do 1 minute sampling of a storm instead of 15 minute sampling or a half hour sampling.
You do the 1 minute video of Sandy last year.
Yeah, it's just incredible to see how active those storms are. Yeah. You know, normally we think of it as this big blob of white moving.
Yeah.
And that's not what's happening. It's a lot of dynamics going on in
that
thing.
They're alive.
Yeah.
They're
alive. Yeah.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good.
Well, Clayton emailed us and wonders if you can explain how supercells are formed and how they work.
Supercell thunderstorms are thunderstorms that involve in an environment where there's so much difference in the speed and direction of the winds with elevation changes in the vertical direction that that speed and direction change in the vertical produces horizontally rotating tubes of air. And the supercell converts them into vertically rotating tubes of air. So that's why when you're in the environment of supercell, you can sometimes see the whole cloud mass rotating, even if it's only, you know, 5 kilometers across or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's eerie. It's really scary. And so in that same environment, much more localized vortices can be spawned that draw upon that vertical rotation and condense it, or I should say concentrate it into a region that is a tornado. So it's really the supercell thunderstorm is a thunderstorm that occurs in an environment of vertical wind shear that's sufficient enough to produce vertical rotation, vertically oriented rotation, which can occasionally spawn a tornado.
Wow. John was wondering about wind shear and how wind shear, what happens with wind shear?
And it's just kind of related to what I was talking about. There's two kinds of wind shear. People refer to horizontal wind shear as just a difference in the speed and direction of the wind across a horizontal plane, from Chicago to Madison. And then vertical wind shear is differences in the wind speed and direction in an individual location, but in the vertical direction up and down over that location, say right over Madison. And it's the vertical wind shear that is the most prominent factor that's involved in converting a regular thunderstorm into a supercell in the manner that I just described.
Okay. And the wind shear, I wonder if he was getting at the horizontal one that knocks down trees and just flattens an area. How does that get formed?
That's usually, you're going to get big horizontal shears in the wind from the being locally near or between weather systems. If you have a big high to your west and a big low to your east, you'll have really strong horizontal winds. If you're in the immediate vicinity of either one of those disturbances, most often a region of low pressure, you're going to have strong differences, big differences in the horizontal wind speed and direction from one location to another across the southern part of the state, for instance.
Uh-huh.
And they can sometimes be associated with severe events, but not always. It's just usually not, in fact.
Huh. Talking weather with our two guests today, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. If you have a weather-related question or a climate question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and certainly we'd love to hear from you. I was surprised, kind of a quiet bunch today.
It's such a beautiful day. Everybody's
outside.
Trying to get that last gardening
work.
Right.
Or they know what's coming.
Viewing the beautiful color of the trees up north.
I tell you what, this weather is really kind of wonderful
this
weather.
This is perfect weather. This is one of the reasons why we live out here. And John lives out here for the winter storms, but not me. I like the fall.
I like September, too. I mean, when I'm retired, I'm taking my vacation in September. Definitely. You can have July and August. I want September.
Where are you going to go?
Oh, I don't know.
North?
I don't think it matters.
Oh.
I mean, you can go anywhere.
But in the state.
What are
you going to say? Yeah.
Either in the state or even further south. It doesn't matter. It's so nice everywhere in September.
Mm.
You know? So that's my
opinion. You got to go to New Orleans.
I was talking to, and you guys are from the East, originally from the East. I was talking to a guy this morning who's taking his new bride out east, New Hampshire, Vermont, and he was talking about the color.
Oh yeah,
the tree color. He said it is a huge business.
It is.
Yeah.
It's an enormous business. The fall foliage in New England and even in Laurentide, Canada. We got a kind of a low rate where we were last week, but you can see that's a tourist industry. And you can see why when you're there. It's beautiful. Absolutely stunning.
He said they have a hard time. They had a hard time even actually getting some rooms where they wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people were saying, well, you know, we actually have people who book a year ahead.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I've heard that same thing.
So it must be. I mean, Wisconsin fall colors are also really beautiful. They don't seem to have as much varied as I remember in New York. But New York, it must be dealing with the big cities, the population moving north.
Maybe that's it.
I don't know if you guys, certainly the weather has an impact on the color of trees.
Yeah.
You want these kind of days where it gets sunny and warm during the day and then
and
gets below
50 at night, or 45
below 40
at night.
Or something like that.
And what does it do?
It what you want to do is get the chlorophyll out of the leaves, but still not destroy the other chemicals that carry the colors, like the carotenes and the something with
xanthine,
an A.
Xanthine is an X in there too. I don't know what it's called, but
To keep them in there.
So you must want to encourage the plant to convince itself that winter is coming, get the sugar into the stem, get it out
right,
the
leaves,
and so on.
Store some of the energy, but still gather some,
some of the solar energy. It's sunny and warm, so that keeps them trying to produce more sugar, and then it's cold at night, so they say we better just shut down. Yeah, we got
to
do a little of both here, so that's what happens. And then elevation probably helps. I bet the soil type matters. You know, the maple trees at high elevation are different from maple trees on your lawn,
Well, supposedly it was much more spectacular color out there than there is here, and I often wondered about that, too.
That's because you have to rake them.
Yeah, so, that's right.
You don't necessarily appreciate them as much.
That's true enough.
As we look ahead to weather here in Wisconsin, let's talk a little bit about that. What can you guys tell us about what's coming up?
I just got back from a trip, so I can't even give you my normal 10-day forecast. I didn't pay any attention this morning getting ready for various other things. But I'm still thinking we are not going to be as cold as we could have, as we usually are in November and December, unless things change abruptly in the Western Hemisphere, because there's no way there's any snow on the ground in Western Canada. And in the absence of snow on the ground there, we just can't get the air cold early in the season, early in the winter season, late in the fall. So I'll say that right now. And maybe an update next time we see each other in late October, but at least up till now, there's been no chance of some unusually early snow up there, which would give us an unusually better than average chance of being cold in late October, November, December.
And so you're basing this on the current research that you're doing?
One of my colleagues, our colleague Ankur Desai, is a boundary layer guy. We want to combine snow cover with this cold pool, but it's especially probably important at the early part of the season, because these trends in the cold area are the same in the southern hemisphere, and that's around Antarctica, which is always snow covered. So it's not snow that does it in the midst of the in the depths of the season, but it might be at the beginning.
So, well, Antarctica is 600 millibars too.
True, yeah, there's a lot of differences.
It's pretty high.
There's a lot of differences, but there's snow is not a, a distinguishing characteristic.
Okay. And Donna New Richmond wanted to go back to hurricanes for a minute, because you said if there's no hurricanes or they're very low, that this is creating, could create some real issue problems, and he's wondering what do you mean? What do you mean by what are some situations that could occur?
That's another of our colleagues, Greg Tripoli, who, if Don's in driving distance, he might want to come and listen to the seminar he's going to give on Wednesday. Greg's got a whole new theory that's beginning to evolve in his head about the general circulation of the atmosphere, and both tropics and extratropics, and it involves the role of tropical cyclones in a very significant way. And in the absence of those storms, there is a distribution of energy that's created over the course of the warm season in the northern hemisphere that he believes needs to be bled away gradually by connection between tropical and extratropical weather systems. And in the absence of tropical weather systems, there hasn't been any bleeding of that energy, so it's available for the full bore wintertime. And he has a suspicion there'll be some really major weather systems in the late fall and early winter as a consequence of this buildup without bleeding away. Tropical cyclones are one way to bleed them away, and it hasn't happened. So he's concerned that it'll be a really uproarious fall and winter.
And that would be for the entire country or for...
Really, the whole hemisphere, distributed around the hemisphere. But the country represents a big part of that, so we'd probably feel a lot of that.
So right here in Wisconsin, we'd...
Could be. It could be.
So it'll be interesting to look at some of these, you know, historic November storms that we've had over the years, you know, like the one that sank the Edmund Fitzgerald. Look at the hurricane season prior to that.
Right. What was that like? That's a good idea.
See what that was like.
See if there's any correlation at all between a weak hurricane season and a really stormy fall and early winter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You must have some undergraduates or grad...
I do. I'm meeting with one on Wednesday. We're going to talk to you
about
this.
Somebody looking for an independent study?
now that I'm not chair, I can do these things. I'm really excited about it, you know? It's great.
Someone else wondered about a good book about the weather. Is there a good book out there about the, you know, for...
I have a great textbook out there.
Yeah, Steve's book
called Meteorology.
Is great.
Understanding the Atmosphere by Eckerman and Knox. Knox is a former student of ours and a colleague now down in Georgia. Great educator, great scientist, great writer.
And so
our book just came out, our fourth edition just came out. It was just published. Yep.
And what's it, what's the title again?
Meteorology, Understanding the Atmosphere. So it's not, it's a, I think it's a very well-written textbook. I mean, it is a textbook. We update it every 2 or 3 years because usually there's a big weather event that comes along. Yeah. So we've added to 2012, crazy severe weather season, for example. But there are a lot of stories in there. I mean, for example, our whole chapter on mid-latitude cyclones or winter storms tells the story of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald and what the storm was doing and what the ship was doing and how that's related to the famous song. Who, by the way, he's changed the words.
Really?
Yeah. From, I'm going to forget what it is. But, you know, there's one part of the song, which generally is very accurate, but there's a statement in there that's wrong. You know, like, you know,
and
like,
he changed it?
And he changed it. Yeah. We tried to get the rights to publish it, and we did in the third edition. And in the fourth edition, they said, yes, but you have to change this line to this. And that line was, fellas, it's been good to know you, indicating that they knew they were going down where they did not know they were going down.
Oh, yeah.
And so with that, really, we're done.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Weather Guys will be back next month. Stay with us.